Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. We're going to head back to the good old Cold War today. Independent journalist and historian Gareth Porter returns to our podcast today to talk about the new Cold War with Russia and the fact-free package of allegations and assertions, some blessed by our intelligence agencies, that drive this unsubstantiated conversation. Gareth published a piece at Consortium News, and I'm linking to it in the show file for this podcast. It's the basis of our conversation. And we'll also talk a little bit about Yemen toward the end of this interview. It's all made possible by listeners who support my work with your subscriptions. People like Cheryl Fleming, Dick Attlee, and, of course, Mark Brodsky and Billy Cook. They're all monthly subscribers here, and I appreciate their support. You can join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on Menu, then click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and I would love to receive your support. Is the U.S. heading toward a new war with Russia? A cold one or a hot one?
Yeah. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
Gareth Porter returns to the Peter B. Collins podcast today, journalist, historian, independent thinker. And Gareth, welcome back to the program. It's always good to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Peter. Glad to be back on.
You penned a piece that's been published recently at consortiumnews.com. It will, of course, be linked to in the show file for today's podcast. And Bob Perry, was the editor there at Consortium News, was on with me recently. And that has been one of the outlets that has really provided important journalism and credible skepticism in the face of all of these unproven stories that have been published and embraced as fact by the corporate media, centering around Russian interference in our election, the claims unproven still that Russia hacked the DNC and John Podesta. And this has led to a whole new series of chapters. And I want to start, as I told you before we started recording, Gareth, with your final statement, the final line in this powerful and important piece. And it is a warning. You say, progressives in the anti-Trump movement are in danger of becoming an unwitting ally of military and intelligence bureaucracies, despite the fundamental conflict between their economic and political interests and the desires of people who care about peace, social justice, and the environment. Explain what you mean there, please.
Well, it's very simple. You know, what has been happening over the last couple of months, really, is that there is this campaign of using leaks from former Obama administration intelligence officials, particularly John Brennan, a former CIA director, to implicate Trump aides and indeed Trump himself in sort of being having an illicit understanding or a deal of some sort, or at least configuring some sort of understanding with the Russians about rolling back the sanctions or basically ending the state of tension that has been created during the Obama administration. And that has been that has become a kind of a general cry, a war cry on the part of Democrats and people, generally speaking, on the left. Not everyone, of course, but this has become sort of a broad, sweeping generalization that people have made who don't like Trump for very legitimate reasons, but who have gotten on this bandwagon. And I believe that this is a very dangerous situation. I mean, I am as much of an opponent of Trump as an individual, as a president. I certainly would never have counseled anyone to support him for the presidency. And I think he's going to cause a world of trouble for this country, regardless of this issue of whether there was any linkage with the Russians. But to have the former intelligence officials begin and to carry out this campaign, which is based on innuendo and not on any evidence whatever, and to regard that as the basis for taking this kind of position is something that I think sets a very dangerous precedent for interference or intervention in domestic politics by the intelligence officials of the administration, of whatever administration, and puts the progressive left in the position really of being dependent on people who do not have their interest at heart at all.
And Gareth, my listeners don't need to hear a stipulation that there isn't an ounce of support from me for Donald Trump. But I share your concerns that we have seen, driven by the Obama administration, the administration that cracked down on leakers more aggressively than any administration before it, yet they have, if not authorized, tolerated brazen and repeated high-level intelligence leaks that form this fabric, this quilt of innuendo, as you suggested. And there is still not a shred of evidence that's been made public that supports the notion, and there's been such a storm of disclosures that it all gets lumped together. And I want to point out that there are 143.5 million people in Russia, and the sloppy journalism and the sloppy commentary from many of our elected officials just says, oh, Russia did this, or Russians did it. And we do have some explicit allegations that Russian intelligence, for example, had frequent communications with members of the Trump campaign or allies. They never name any of those individuals, so we have no way of evaluating those claims. So we have a house of mirrors here, and the media is stoking it, and it is clear that former Obama administration officials have been very active in essentially setting up a ring of fire around Donald Trump to try to prevent him from easing the tensions with Russia. And I'm not opposed.
Right.
I'm not opposed to easing tensions with Russia. Go ahead.
Just to add to that, I mean, I think people should understand that these officials clearly began this process, began this effort months before. In fact, it has been stated explicitly by some of the officials to the media on background. They don't identify themselves. That they, at the suggestion of Obama administration officials, at the time of the hacking of the DNC, of the offices associated with the leaks that then became public through WikiLeaks, that is last spring and early summer, the intelligence agencies began their own investigation to try to come up with evidence that Trump's team was, in fact, in illicit contact with the Russians in order to reach a deal that would basically repeal the sanctions and basically return to some kind of normal relationship. So this is a process, this is a campaign that began at the behest of the Obama administration itself, carried out by the intelligence agencies. Again, I would emphasize if I haven't, I can't remember if I've already said it, but it's John Brennan, the then director of the CIA, who is clearly the ringleader of this. The evidence for that is pretty clear from multiple perspectives. But they did this at the behest of the administration, trying to find evidence that would link Trump to the hacking of the DNC and the Russian intention to help him in the election. And that began began before the middle of last year. So this is more than simply intelligence agencies operating on their own for intelligence purposes.
And Gareth, one of the perhaps unintended, but I'll have to leave that for later judgment, but one of the true consequences of this whole operation has been that whatever firewalls remained separating the CIA from any kind of domestic activity, separating the NSA from any domestic surveillance, that was in both of the charters of the agencies back in the National Security Act of 1947. And yet, because we've created this hysteria about Russia, I have heard no criticism of the fact that Obama turned to the CIA and NSA to join the FBI in what is clearly a domestic-based operation or investigation, and not an eyebrow was raised about that. This is the new normal where, you know, that stuff doesn't matter. The Constitution is optional. The charters of these agencies, it's subject to interpretation, and whoever's in the White House at the moment. But this is part of the slippery slope to a police state, and I, for one, just want to call it out here.
Right. Well, I agree with you, of course, entirely on that point. But I do want to just make sure people understand that this is not entirely a new phenomenon. What you're describing here, which is the violation of the domestic laws in this country that are supposed to protect American citizens from being the object of intercepted conversations, emails, and so forth. That's been going on for quite a while, and indeed, there's now a story out of the UK that is reporting that the former head of GHQ, that is the British version of the National Security Agency, which is involved in signals, intelligence, interception, and so forth, has had to resign, and doesn't give any reason, but my understanding, based on a column by the former CIA official, operations official, I'm sorry, now I've lost his name.
Is that Mike Morrell?
No, not Mike Morrell.
He's been writing a lot.
This is the good guy who is... who writes for the American Conservative. I'll come up with it in a moment.
Are you thinking of Phil Giraldi?
Phil Giraldi just did a column in which he reports that his sources make it clear that what happened was that the NSA, FBI, simply got GHQ in Britain to send the request for the interception or for the use of the intercept for an investigation, so that they didn't have to do it. This is what they've been doing all along. We can't spy on American citizens. That is, CIA and NSA, FBI can't spy on American citizens. GHQ can't spy on British citizens. But so we spy on British citizens. They spy on us, and we just exchange the information. That's the way it works.
I understand the end run, and they've been using that quite a bit in recent years. That's a very good point. Now, Gareth, one of the centerpieces of the string of innuendo is a report that was issued on January 6th that President Obama had asked for it, and it was an assessment. That's the term that was used. And they assessed with high confidence that Russia had attempted to interfere with our elections. But again, there was no evidence presented. And this 25-page document was filled with blank pages. Seven of the pages were a very strange and bizarre attack on the RT network. claiming that its influence is up at the level of, say, CNN or Fox in this country, and using flatly false information that had been true 2 years before. But, for example, they used some headlines and graphics from a show that Abby Martin had did, questioning the legitimacy of American elections, and they were claiming that that was influenced by Moscow. Well, Abby Martin hasn't worked at RT for 2 years. She criticized Russia over Ukraine on RT and kept her job. But nonetheless, you know, they take that one picture of Mike Flynn in Moscow with Jill Stein and Vladimir Putin at the same table, and the guilt by association just rolls right off of them. And
and let me just add more to that critique of the January 6th document that was issued not by the entire intelligence community, but by a select few intelligence heads. Acting, as far as I can tell, on their own. First point I want to make is that, you know, the key thing about that document, of course, is that that was when they first suggested to the American public that the Russians were trying to help get Trump elected. That was the political message that was being sent with the assessment, as you correctly termed it. And secondly, interestingly, it was not all of the three major intelligence agencies who agreed that they had high confidence in that judgment. In fact, it was NSA who said they had only moderate confidence in that judgment, specifically about the Russians having the aspiration or aspiring to help Trump get elected. They had only moderate confidence, and that means very explicitly in the parlance of the intelligence community that they think it is plausible, but that's about all. In other words, no real evidence for it.
Well, and Gareth, as we look at the way this document was used, again, it was described as the ultimate proof. And it's the kind of thing like, you know, people who use Facebook and they read a headline and they draw an inference from it. They don't bother to click on the article and read the whole thing. And I can't imagine that very many Americans bothered to read this 25-page or so report. And, you know, it is now treated as fact. And we've seen David Remnick and his colleagues from The New Yorker who wrote this 13,000-word exposé. And there is some interesting stuff in there and some new information. It doesn't
Very good stuff. I agree. Absolutely. But, it's a must-read as far as I'm concerned.
But it doesn't support any of the earlier allegations explicitly that Russia hacked the DNC and John Podesta and gave that to WikiLeaks. And
absolutely not.
And yet,
there's nothing in it.
Yet the New Yorker reporters, I saw them on the public television news hour, just treat that as flat fact. And I hear these talking heads go on TV and everybody knows that Russia hacked the DNC. Well, when you start with a lie, then everything else that it's based on has to be treated skeptically, in my view. And ultimately, there may be proof of this stuff. I freely acknowledge that. But at this point, we don't have it. And yet there's been this, you know, headlong rush that is partisan. We see the Democrats, you know, just buying it without any question. And as Nancy Pelosi today on March 2nd, is calling for Jeff Sessions to resign because he denied two meetings with the Russian ambassador that have now been revealed, I would look at her and say, Nancy, my friend, and I've known Nancy for 30 years now, I would say, well, why were you silent when James Clapper perjured himself before a Senate committee? And, you know, this selective use of perjury, and I do believe that Sessions intentionally withheld that information. I think that he is probably a perjurer. But I just have to be honest that this is partisan in many respects. And I don't have a molecule of support for Jeff Sessions. At the same time, I think that we have to have a unified standard here, and that's certainly not the case.
That is a problem. I agree. Absolutely. And, you know, just to go back to the to the general point about the January 6th document. I think that was the beginning of this. This was the beginning of a campaign that clearly was being thought through by people around John Brennan, who, again, I think it's very clear he began the process because he personally wrote or had written his own CIA paper making the case that the Russians were trying to help Trump in the election. And then he basically got the others to go along with it. This was a Brennan operation from the very beginning. But I do want to make one distinction here that I think your listeners need to be aware of. And that is that there's no question that the Russians, quote, hacked the DNC. In other words, they were able to access information from the DNC's network or networks. And that's not a controversial statement because the kind of thing that all major intelligence agencies do. I mean, they're capable of doing it. They're doing it to all institutions like that all the time. That's not controversial. What is controversial is that they then used the information that they got, they passed it on to WikiLeaks. Now, people should understand that Clapper testified publicly that the intelligence community did not have good insight into the sequence of deliveries of the of those documents to WikiLeaks and when it was done. That means they do not know who did it. He was basically admitting that the intelligence community does not know who did it.
And Gareth, my most credible source on this is Bill Binney, who was technical director at the NSA before he resigned in protest. And Bill is clear that the NSA has the capability of tracking actual hacks. And to the extent that Russia may have hacked DNC servers, the NSA is able to verify that and also to trace, at least up to the point where they used devices to mask the originating IP addresses, they are able to trace that. And that's why Bill Binney and his colleagues flatly believe that the DNC information that made it to WikiLeaks came from an insider leak and not from a Russian hack. And I don't dispute that Russia intended to hack and probably succeeded, but we have no proof that the information that was credible and highly critical of Clinton and her campaign was released by WikiLeaks, but we still don't know where they got it. And I accept Julian Assange's representations repeatedly that it didn't come from the Russian government.
And then I agree with what you said, of course, and I just want to add another layer to this analysis, to this picture, and that is that I really object to the entire coloration, the tone of the U.S. Intelligence community and the Obama administration's position on this whole issue, which is that this entire issue is something that is so far beyond the rules of the game in international politics that this requires that all people of goodwill must get together and denounce and totally oppose the Russians for their behavior. In fact, I mean, I think that this needs to be understood in light of the distinction between the kind of propaganda that the United States and the Russians have been carrying on throughout the Cold War, which was based on falsification of data, falsification of information, disinformation campaigns, and what was done through WikiLeaks, which is to tell the truth, to get the truth out. That never gets discussed in the context of this whole issue, and it seems to me it has to be part of the picture. It could not be viewed as a threat to American democracy when there's no doubt that this got information to the American public, which was true information. It was the truth.
Well, and most critically, and I've said this before, but of all of the Podesta emails that were revealed, the most damaging was the memo written by Doug Band, the president of the Clinton Foundation, and also the founder of a lobby shop called Teneo, where he spelled out in critical detail how he had built Bill Clinton Incorporated, and how if Hillary were elected, Bill was set to receive $63 million in contracts for fees, for speeches and consulting that Doug Band had set up through Teneo with major corporations. And
right.
and so we were going to have the first completely bought and paid for corporate sponsored first spouse if all of that played out as they had hoped. And I think that the corruption that was exposed in that memo is quite significant. And, you know, it was essentially a one-day story when it came out in October. But I think that, you know, putting aside all of the smokescreen that was created to try to keep us, divert our attention from the content of these emails, they also clearly showed how the DNC colluded with the Clinton campaign to block Bernie Sanders. And
exactly.
So these had critical content, and they used the Russia meme to get a particularly Clinton loyalists to just refuse to look at that stuff or believe it.
Right. And in other words, this is the information that a American media press outfit that is doing its job correctly would have been published. And it was not. It only published it because it came out in WikiLeaks. So in effect, what we're seeing in this whole issue play out is the fact that whoever did in fact give these documents to WikiLeaks, whether it was the Russians or somebody else, was doing a favor to American democracy rather than endangering the electoral process, as the John Brennan group of people have tried to persuade the American public.
And Gareth, let me get your reaction to this, because one of my bottom line views here is that if Obama, if Clinton, if Podesta, if Brennan, if all these people truly believe that Russia successfully manipulated our elections and picked Trump over Clinton, then why on earth did they allow him to take office? They had many ways of, you know, using the legal system. They didn't participate in the partial recounts that took place. And we learned critical information in Michigan about, you know, chicanery that possibly could have flipped that outcome in Trump's favor. And so if they truly believe this stuff, why didn't they make a challenge at the Electoral College? Why didn't they try to prevent him when the Congress certified the election, I believe it was about January 8th or 9th? We had, I believe, 10 African-American members of the House who placed formal objections to the election of Donald Trump, and not a single Democratic senator would sustain one of those objections. Now, I am not delusional to believe that our current political system would have changed the outcome, but they didn't even try, Gareth. And if they really believe all this stuff that they've fed to the media and amplified on MSDNC, then why did they sit on their hands? Why were they content to pass evidence around to other government agencies in some sort of a doomsday plan to sink Trump later? I just don't get it.
Well, it's a good question. I don't know the answer. And, you know, one would have to interrogate the relevant officials of the Democratic Party and the Obama administration to find out the answer, obviously.
So, Gareth, before we move on from this, I want to talk a little bit about Yemen before we wrap up. Is there anything that you'd like to add to this conversation that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, I mean, basically, there are more parts to the story of the campaign of leaks by the former intelligence agency officials, again led by John Brennan, that I cover in my article that I think are really important to understand. I would just emphasize just in one paragraph about this, that the final segment of this campaign, which is the one that occurred in roughly in mid-February, and was based on stories from New York Times and CNN that the Trump team had been in touch with Russians, in illicit contact with Russians during the period of the alleged hacking in late spring and early summer of last year. That whole storyline is based on a whole series of sort of bait and switch maneuvers by the people who put out the story. The headlines in both New York Times and CNN were very clear that the evidence has been put forward that Trump aides were in touch with intelligence officials or senior officials of the Russian government. Clearly, very suspicious situation. If you read carefully the two stories, what you find out is that there are all kinds of caveats. There are all kinds of limits on how far this story went that help to explain how they could be putting out information that somehow makes it look like there was illicit contact, but in fact doesn't amount to anything at all. I won't go into the details, but for example, what the New York Times story said was that the administration people, and this is what I started out with, the administration people were trying to find evidence that the Trump people were in illicit contact with the Russians, but they never were able to get any evidence, despite having checked out all of these meetings, looking at the transcript of conversations and so forth, never found any evidence. But that is not what the headline said. That's not what the lead said. The headline and the lead should have said, Obama administration tries to get evidence of illicit contact with the Russians and Trump, and they didn't find any. They were not able to find any. Mm-hmm. So this is just by way of emphasizing just how a complete travesty of journalism and of politics this whole exercise has been.
And I'll just add one more piece here, Gareth, that the New Yorker article that we referred to provided very substantive information about the activities of Wilbur Ross. Now, the Commerce Secretary job is not that important to me, but the fact that Ross still owns a bank in Cyprus that is a site for Russian money laundering, and I'll just limit it to that. There's much more that's been revealed. But 21 Democratic senators voted to confirm Wilbur Ross as Commerce Secretary. And you just have to scratch your head and say, well, gosh, you know, the information is right there in front of you, and yet you will paper over it. And not even, you know, just call for an extra day of hearings to say, hey, Mr. Ross, you want to explain this stuff?
unless in fact there's something wrong with the information that the New Yorker published and that people in the Senate were aware of that and they didn't want to get trapped into something that it would be shown that there was nothing to it. I mean, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Well, Gareth, let's talk for a minute here about Yemen, because in his joint session, the speech the other night, the president put the spotlight on the widow of the American commando who was killed in that raid, the first one that Trump authorized. And there are many questions that linger, like what the hell are we doing in Yemen in the first place, and why are we supporting the Saudis in their efforts there? And I also note that the corporate media repeatedly omits a critical fact that the 8-year-old daughter of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen she was killed in that raid. And we hear about women and children killed, but we never, you know, hear specifically that an American citizen was in the mix there. And, you know, Trump's spotlight on the widow, I thought, was really tawdry. Yet it is a piece of emotional propaganda that has a great deal of impact, and we're seeing that in the follow-up coverage. But all of this really, you know, again, throws up another smokescreen about Yemen and Obama's, you know, insertion of American forces there. There is no legal basis for U.S. military operations in Yemen. The idea that al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, which did not exist at the time of the 2001 AUMF authorization for use of military force, was given to Bush, it's just irrational and incoherent. And yet it is part of the military machinery that just keeps chugging along and killing a lot of people in the process.
Well, apropos of that point, Peter, let me just add that, in my view, a big part of the problem in U.S. relations with policy toward Yemen over the years has been that both the CIA and the Special Operations Forces have been competing for trying to get control over the use of drones and for the authority to carry out operations in the country targeting supposedly al-Qaeda. So this has been a kind of field of play for these two powerful bureaucracies, the CIA and the Special Operations Forces in the military, to advance their own institutional interests at the expense of very, very many Yemenis, because particularly the Special Operations Forces have never had adequate intelligence to carry out any operations at all. And this has been shown over and over again. They've made one mistake after another in drone strikes or missile strikes in the country, and now in this commando raid, which killed 25 civilians, 19 civilians, women and children, out of 25. At least that was the last report that I saw. So, I mean, what we need to do is just to stop these people from operating there and elsewhere under similar circumstances in the Middle East. But I want to emphasize, and I know you are eager to have me talk about this as well, the real issue, the terrible truth about Yemen is that that the people of Yemen are facing starvation. This could be the worst starvation that we have seen anywhere in the world for many, many years. It could be hundreds of thousands of people starving to death, and it could be, and it will be, if that happens. And at this moment, the chances seem very, very strong that that will be the case. It will be because of American policy, because the United States supported the Saudi war of destruction against Yemen, and when that war of destruction of bombing of civilian targets throughout the most of the country failed militarily, failed to force the Houthis and their allies, the former President Saleh's forces, to give up or to yield any ground to them, then the Saudis, with American support, turned to a even more terrible strategy, which is to use starvation as a weapon. And to make a long story short, what they've done is to make it impossible for even the most minimal economic activity to take place in the vast majority of the territory of Yemen by getting rid of the Central Bank of Yemen, which was the last institution that was supporting, as I say, this sort of minimal level of economic activity by allowing merchants to be able to obtain goods from outside the country, because 90% of the food, fuel, and medicine that Yemen uses has to be imported from outside the country. And so they need foreign exchange. Now what the Saudis have done, again with American support, is to deprive the Yemenis of the ability to get foreign exchange in order to get the most basic goods. That's the short version of it. I'm going to be working on a story on this, so I don't want to get into much more detail.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gareth, the other thing that, and I share your deep concern about a humanitarian crisis, and The U.S. and many of our former partners are, I think, experiencing a kind of compassion fatigue that will allow many people to say, oh, Yemen, they're starving. Okay. The other real serious issue is that the new administration may use Yemen as a pretext to confront Iran. And on the day that Mike Flynn was forced out of the administration, the new defense secretary, General Mattis, he came very close to ordering the interdiction of an Iranian ship bound for Yemen in international waters. And he had some suspicion that there might be military supplies there, and I certainly have no knowledge of what might have been on that ship. But the risk of a military confrontation with Iran seems to be something that the Trump administration is eager for, and the call for a huge spike in defense spending with no real rationale behind it suggests to me that they're itching for war. Iran is the target, and Yemen could be the proxy that creates some casus belli.
Well, I agree with you that you know, the statements made by people in the Trump administration, particularly Mattis, are extremely belligerent toward Iran and dangerously so. I do not want to minimize the seriousness of that. On the other hand, I think we also need to consider that one of the characteristics of this administration is a decidedly blustering way of talking, even when they do not have the slightest idea of what they're going to do about something. And I mean, that was clear on February 1st when Flynn himself said, we're putting Iran, quote, on notice. And then Trump himself tweeted that that evening. That set off, of course, a whole set of press stories about the danger of war with Iran, or speculating on the possibilities of that. I think that they're nowhere close at this point to at least intending to launch a war on Iran or to get a war started. And the reason is very simple, that Iran has the capability to do great damage to the U.S. military. And this is one of the characteristics of the U.S. military over the decades, as I have begun to understand as I read carefully the history of U.S. wars and their origins, is that the United States military always picks on those states and armies that are easy pickings. They do not pick on countries that can really do damage in return. And I think this is has been the situation now for the last 15 or 20 years with Iran. And so that does give a little bit more assurance that there will be more caution about going to war with Russia than is reflected in the rhetoric of this administration.
Gareth Porter, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I appreciate your coverage and your commentary, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Peter. Glad to be back again.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Gareth Porter. Send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.